From KCBW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. It's hard to imagine being violently forced from your home with little more than the clothing on your back, or being arrested and tortured because of your father's political views, or spending years in a tent camp with thousands of other refugees. The hardship continues even after refugees are relocated into a safer environment. These new residents still face the jarring realities of learning a language, finding housing and a job, and adjusting to a very foreign society. There are now 25,000 refugees living in Utah, and today on the program we're talking about the refugee experience and how well refugees are integrating into Utah's culture. Plus, remembering the environmental giant, David Brower. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. They come from every corner of the earth seeking shelter and protection and a new life. Every year, hundreds of refugees come to Utah to escape persecution in their homeland. They bring with them the rich traditions, languages, and even recipes of their native lands, but they often struggle to adjust to their new surroundings. Today on the program, we're talking about the refugee experience here in Utah, the services available, and what more needs to be done to help refugees acclimate to their new country and community. Joining me this hour is Zeman Zhao. She is the Salt Lake County Refugee Services Liaison. And Z, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Also with us, Dr. Xu Chang. He is the Executive Director of the Refugee and Immigrant Center at the Asian Association of Utah, which helps improve the quality of life for refugees through teaching and self-reliance. And Dr. Chang, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Nawal Nawal, he is the Supervisor for Employment and Supportive Services for the Refugee and Immigrant Center. Nawal Nawal, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Refugee organizations in Utah and around the world will celebrate World Refugee Day. That's coming up in June. We'll have more details on that as we go. Later on in the program, we remember the father of the modern environmental movement, David Brower. But first, refugees in Utah. How have refugees in Utah touched your life? And what more can be done to help refugees adjust to Utah's culture? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Nawal Nawal, I'd like to start with you. In addition to your official position at the Refugee and Immigration Center, I understand you're a refugee yourself from Sudan. Tell us a little bit about your experience and how you came to Utah.
Yeah, that is correct. I'm a refugee myself, and I came to Utah in September 1998. And from that time until now, I'm here in Utah.
What was that journey like for you, coming from Sudan? What were the circumstances of your life in Sudan before you were shipped to America?
As you know, if you go back to 1983, when the war erupted in in Sudan, I was in high school at that time, and couldn't go back to South Sudan because of war, because the South Sudan is the field of the war. All these 21 years. And I had an opportunity to go to Egypt, where I attended my college. And in 1998, I got an opportunity to be here in the United States through UNHCR, which is United Nations High Commission for Refugees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what were the feelings going on, the emotions that went through your mind as you boarded that plane and as you deplaned here in Utah? What were you feeling?
I was coming to somewhere, I don't know, actually, and it really took me 11 hours to fly from Cairo to New York, which was really the longest one I have ever. Yeah, and I came to Utah, and the first thing that I faced was the weather, you know.
What time of year did you arrive?
I came in September.
Uh-huh.
And as you know, in 1998, there was an early winter in that year. And it was really first experience, because I never, experienced the snow. That was the first thing to face here, you know, because all these years I grew up, I just see the snow in the screen of TVs or, the other shows. But I never experienced, physically until I came here.
That so must that have been was very strange.
Yes.
Dr. Chang, define for us exactly what a refugee is. A refugee is distinct. It's apart from what an immigrant is.
Right. I don't have the official description, but it is an individual that trying to escape from persecution based on religion, political ideas, and as well as other reasons. And, you know, refugee status is granted by the United Nations High Commission on Refugees. So for them to qualify, they have to pass through an interview and granted a visa. Then they could be resettled by international communities to any of the various countries. United States is one of them. Other European countries, Australia, and other countries as well.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just the desire for a better life. They have to be escaping persecution of some kind for their race, for their religion, political views, et cetera.
Correct. And sometimes it could be even, because of fear of physical harm, could be even tribal conflicts. And that happens quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And then recently you have a situation in which individuals who live in a country but really did not have the citizenship in those countries, and it become individuals with no protection or no nationality, and so some cases were being granted as refugee status as well.
Mm-hmm. So many hotspots around the world, you know, facing hardship and violence. 25,000 of these refugees now live in Utah, and most of them live here in the Salt Lake Valley. Zeman Zhao, where are the refugees who relocate to Utah? Where are they coming from?
Well, they come from various parts of the world, and the resettlement process is a little bit complicated, because less than 1% of the refugees population in the world today gets a chance to come to a third country resettlement.
Less than 1%?
Less than 1%.
Wow, you're a lucky man, Noaldemar.
And in order to be a refugee, and Dr. Chu mentioned this earlier, is that you have to escape from the country that you're from and cannot go back because of fear. And so to receive refugee status is a complicated process by itself. You have to escape to another country, and that country doesn't want you. So a refugee is basically someone who have no country. So the United States, we saw those refugees as a humanitarian effort. Mm-hmm. And they try to choose refugees that are in the most risk. Most at risk, meaning that if we don't give them an opportunity to come to the United States and start a new life, they won't have a life at all.
How many of the refugees that we see here in Utah are children?
I don't have the exact statistics on that, but I would estimate that more than half of them would be children. A lot of times refugees do come from large families. And the trend really varies depending on what year and what's going on in the world today. And going back to your first question about who are the refugees that are coming into our community, if you look at the newer populations that are arriving, we have a lot of Iraqis that came in the past couple of years, and we understand the reasons for that. And they do come in families, although we do have some singles that come in. The other large population that comes in is from Bhutan, and Nepalese Bhutanese refugees who have lived in Nepal for 18 years of their life.
Wow.
And so they do come in families, often two or three generations of people live coming together with the grandparent, the father and mother, and then the children. So we do have a large aging population with the Bhutanese refugees. And that's true with the Burmese refugees as well, and the different ethnicities in Burma. And the refugees from Burma live in camps in Thailand, sometimes more than 30 years, and they do come in families. So those are the three large populations that of refugees arriving in Utah recently.
Wow. Dr. Xu Cheng, the Salt Lake Tribune recently reported that the number of refugees coming to America and by extension to Utah is declining. What's the reason behind the decline, and do you see this as something of a permanent trend?
I think a lot of the flow of refugees depends on the screening process and from the regions of the world that they are coming from. And after September 11th situation, the Homeland Security has put together a very elaborate screening process to make sure that individuals brought into the countries were not pose any threat to the country. And so there are multiple processes to make sure that individuals are being screened. And so the flow of the refugees and the number is determined by the United States Congress. So there's an annual quota.
Oh, so there is a quota.
Yes,
there is.
There's
a cap set on.
There's a cap every year decided by the Congress. And sometimes with the ebbs and flow, so the beginning of the year and the end of the year, there will be a large number trying to catch up with the quota. And so this going up and down is pretty normal. But it really depends on the regions of the refugee, where they're coming from.
Mm. When did Utah become a refugee destination?
The official refugee resettlement program started in 1980s. However, the refugees has been coming to the United States informally or in other means long before that, mm-hmm. Even in Utah in the 19th, and Dr. Chu could speak more to that.
Well, actually, in the early part of the 1949, when China, mainland became a communistic country, there were refugees here, but there weren't any formalized program to help to resettle them. But in 1980s, with various resettlement agencies, so there are programs that have an official reception, resettlement, and help them with housing and other programs. So it becomes a lot more comprehensive in terms of services.
Hmm. We're talking about the refugee experience here in Utah and how to help refugees acclimate to Utah culture and to America. My guests include Dr. Xu Cheng from the Refugee and Immigrant Center at the Asian Association of Utah, also Nawal Nawal from the Refugee and Immigrant Center, and Zeman Zhao, the Salt Lake County Refugee Services Liaison. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Nawal Nawal, so you land in Salt Lake City. You don't have any experience with the snow. The weather's a bit of a puzzle. How did you transition into getting into an apartment and learning how we live here in the States?
Yeah, when I came here, actually, I was resettled by IRC, which is International Rescue Committee, and they are the one who found me an apartment with a simple setup with two other refugees, because I came here single.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how I get into the apartment. And it was really, the services are not like nowadays. But that time, the resources are so limited. And
so they dropped you off?
No, they put me in the apartment with the simple setup, as I said. I don't want to go in details. you know. So that is how I got into the apartment. And that is, I mean, the same way that they are doing right now. For when the refugees came, they put them in the apartment with, simple stuff like bed, for example, and cooking items, you know, and others. And then also put them in the schools. First of all, I mean, the screening, I mean, health, I mean, the screening. That is important for the refugees, so that they know that they are healthy before they do anything here in this country.
Mm-hmm. Just navigating, you know, knowing when to take the garbage out, or how to go to the grocery store, how to set up a bank account. I mean, those kinds of things. Was it pretty hard to learn on your own, or did somebody help you through, you know, those skills?
I was helped through the agency, and also some friends that came before me actually helped me to set up the account and show me where to take the garbage and how it is important in this country. Actually, before we came here, they give us some, orientation, which is not enough, actually, for me, mm-hmm. you know. And then when right after we came here, they gave us, 3 days, intensive orientation. You know, how the life is here. But for me, it's not enough also. You know, that's why, AAU, or the Refugee Center, is there right now in order to extend this type of case management.
That's kind of your mission, Dr.
Right.
Cheng?
Well, I think it's really important when an individual tries to adapt to a new environment is to make them feel comfortable, make them feel safe. Refugee ran away because of fear. So you have to find ways to reduce those fear and help them to sometimes even overcome trauma that they have experienced in the past. The food and shelter is really the first step, you know, provide a safe place to live and to provide nutritional items for them to, you know, to survive. And so it is important to do that. And then after that would be to learn English and to find jobs. And the resettlement of refugees in Utah is very, very successful in getting jobs.
Mm. We're going to talk about that in a bit after the break, a little more extensively. We're talking about the refugee experience here in Utah. Utahns will mark World Refugee Day on Saturday, June 16th from noon to 6 at Granite High School in South Salt Lake City. And there's more information and a link on our website, kcpw.org. If you've got questions or comments about interactions with refugees or transitions for refugees or how to get involved, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about the 25,000 refugees who now call Utah home and some of the challenges these new residents have breaking into mainstream society. June is Utah Refugee Month. Utahns will mark World Refugee Day on Saturday, June 16th. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join us, what interactions have you had with refugees in Utah, and how can the local refugee community be better served? Give us a call with your thoughts. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Zeman Zhao is Salt Lake County's Refugee Services Liaison. Nawal Nawal is the Supervisor for Employment and Supportive Services for the Refugee and Immigrant Center. And Dr. Xu Cheng is Executive Director of the Refugee and Immigrant Center at the Asian Association of Utah. And again, we invite you to join us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones. Heidi's been holding from Salt Lake City. Heidi, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I had a comment. I moved back from Chicago, where I was originally trained in English as a second language, and I had never done it before. And I got free training there. And then when I moved back to Salt Lake as an empty nester, I got trained further here in Salt Lake at the English Language Center. And I highly recommend it to anybody looking for something rewarding to do, because it helps the refugees out so much to learn English. It's difficult, as you might imagine, to gain employment and to even just maneuver and learn about a new culture and a new way of life without English skills. And it's something that everybody can do. They train you, and you don't have to have prior experience, so I highly recommend it.
Okay. Heidi, thanks very much for the call. One endorsement for volunteering as an ESL instructor. Let's talk about that primary barrier that, language presents. Zeman Zhao, how are people in a refugee situation learning English? And I imagine that the range of languages that we see from new refugees is in the dozens?
Yeah. And they come from everywhere and different degrees of English proficiency. We might have refugees from Iraq who might have higher degrees, higher educational degrees, and speaks relatively well English, versus someone who might have lived in the jungles in Africa for a long time and is illiterate in their own language. So the skill very varies, but English is learning English is one of the most essential ways to get refugees integrated in a community, and is so valuable. We do have classes through the various educational institutions like Granite Peaks that teaches English. Another great program is through the Humanitarian Center, where refugees work but also go to English classes half the time, and really help them improve the English skills. But the best thing that a community could do is really like what Heidi is doing, just volunteer in a community and become an ESL instructor. I could guarantee you that you learn more from the refugees than they learn from you in the English. Mm-hmm. You might be able to learn some words in Swahili.
Which would be super cool.
Yeah.
Dr. Xu Chang, talk about the language barriers, some of the challenges there, and ways that you see agencies working around those challenges right now.
I think language is the bridge to a destination. I think when I saw one of the doctoral study of 350 Cambodian refugees resettled about 25 years ago, and the main thing that they mentioned is the most helpful area was learning the language first, and that really helped them to adjust to become, good parents and also to progress with their career. And teaching English as a volunteer is more than just the language. As you can see, many of the refugees will really treasure their friendship and their way of bridging and to reaching out for community. And sometimes simple things as some people mentioned about making friends in the garden project in which the refugees are doing the gardening, those kind of friendship become very valuable to them because they are very isolated, and for them to have a friend in the community make a huge difference.
Nawal, is there a willingness among the refugee community to learn English, or is that seen as a little troublesome because you want to retain your native language as well, you want to pass that on to your children? Where's the balance there?
I mean, learning English actually is a priority for the refugees in general, and especially the young generation, because the young generation, as soon as they come here, they pick up English immediately. And sometimes they act as the teachers for their parents.
The translators,
yes,
for the family.
Yes, and learning ABCs also, So the learning English is important for the refugees, and the majority of them want that. And as if you go like the institutions that Zin said, most of the refugees are there in order to learn English. Also, we have it in AAU. We have ESL classes also there.
Mm-hmm. Heidi, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Let's go to Juan in Salt Lake City. Juan, hello.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
My name is Juan. I'm a doctoral student at the University of Utah. My experience based on research, learning English is not one day soon. It takes time, and especially to learn not the social language, but to learn the academic or the more technical language, it takes longer, 5 years. I'm not opposed to the idea that refugees need to learn English. Yeah, they have to learn English. I'm totally for it. But it has to be a two-way. If we are bringing refugees from other countries that they are sometimes illiterate and even in their first language, we need to help them here with services in their first language. That's my idea that I would be. That I think that it would help refugees in Utah.
Well, that one, I think it's a point well taken. Thanks very much for the call. And Zeman Zhao, translation services. I mean, is there, do we have the services, the ability in the county to accommodate all of these different languages and dialects?
Well, it's challenging. Oftentimes, we hire refugees within the community to help us. There are always one or two leaders in the community that speaks English well. We rely a lot on the children, like Nawal said. Mm-hmm. But I agree with the caller. The way that we focus on refugee resettlement in Utah is the process of integration. And so that is not just refugees assimilating into a culture, learning our skills, learning our language, but the opposite way is also needed, so that our welcoming community has to be willing to learn from them as well. And so I agree that it has to be a two-way process, whereas the refugees are learning from us, but we also might be learning from them as well. Mm-hmm. And you can see that throughout the United States is a melting pot. And as you can see, a lot of times you can the ethnic minority here have their own languages that newspapers and so on and so forth. And so I think that process is extremely important, and it just makes a community better, a better place to live.
Juan, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. I imagine the goal of everyone involved working with refugees and the refugees themselves is to help them become functioning and productive members of society. You can't really do that without a house, without shelter over your heads. How difficult is it for refugees to find and to keep stable housing? Dr. Chang.
Housing was especially difficult when the housing market was high, like about 4 or 5 years ago, and because the rental would be also high when the housing market is high. In terms of finding housing in Utah, because we have in general, refugee will move into the central city first, living in apartments, and as they are getting more adjusted, they would try to move into more independent homes that they could stay in. And so the process of all of this here requires both the community to help them and also for them to help themselves to find enough income to move into their own home.
Well, that income must come from a job, and it
right.
must be difficult to get a job when you're struggling with the language, you're still adjusting to the way things work in this society. Nawal, advice for the refugees and for the larger community on the employment opportunities out there for refugees.
Employment. Let's go back to the issue of the language, as we said before. Language is important. Brother who called that we should focus on the local languages. For me, it's not. We are not trying in order to let the clients not to learn. To forget about their languages, but they have to learn English in order to manage, in order to adjust and live in this community. Housing is one of the issues for the refugees, especially the largest families, and in particular, the single mom is really very, very important. Even though they work, and because of the language, they cannot get the job that can get them a very decent a house. So they depend on the government, and that is why always we help them in order to apply for housing, especially Section 8 or public housing.
Mm. You know. I read a story of several refugee women who were launching a catering business with the help of Salt Lake County. Salt Lake County volunteers and staff helping them with the business side of a catering business, and they're providing food. And maybe, Z, you can tell us a little bit more about that effort.
Yeah, you know, going back to housing and becoming self-sufficient, the resettlement program in the United States is really focused on employment and self-sufficiency. And they have a very limited period of time to become self-sufficient, and oftentimes from 6 to 8 months. So just imagine someone just drop into Salt Lake City, had to accustom to all our way of living, and then be self-sufficient within the period of time. And oftentimes, within a family structured, one or two or the one member of the household would probably find a job. And the average wage is, I would say, between $9 and $11 an hour. And so try to support a family with $11 an hour in a community today. Mm-hmm. So what the catering program does, it has two ways, is to help the other member of the family, and oftentimes that's the woman in the community. Even though they don't speak English very well, and going back to the process of integration, they have so much assets that they brought into a community today. And one of the great assets, I think, because I like to eat, is food. They have great skills in cooking. The sambosas that one of our clients make is the most amazing little triangles that you ever had. So tasty. So what the program does is to help that member of the family engage in positive activities and use their existing skills to supplement the family with supplemental income. Mm. So we have the catering business is to get a woman out of the household, teach them some basic skills, and then help them to sell their food through catering, mm-hmm, to meetings and so forth. And it is amazingly so popular. We haven't really marketed. Well, I market it, basically. I'm the marketer, but that's that's about it.
You're doing a great job.
But it's you know, it's by word of mouth. People taste the food and they say, wow, this is amazing. How can I get more of it? And it powers the woman. It brings in supplemental income for the family to support, you know, pay for housing, pay for, you know, just really basic essentials. And it's also another way to help them move to the next level so that they can move beyond the poverty level, mm-hmm, save up for buying a house or even send their kids to college.
That's a real success story. We're talking about refugees here in Utah and programs that work and how to smooth the transition into mainstream society. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to Phoenix, who's been waiting in Salt Lake City. Phoenix, hi.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I'm so enjoying this program because I wanted to get involved in the lives of refugees about a year ago, and I went to this wonderful organization, the IRC, International Rescue Committee, and I wanted to make a plug for it for all the listeners who want to get involved and don't know how, because they have so many wonderful programs for, you know, anybody who's got the time to donate. You can. What I'm doing is I'm a family mentor. And I just help my family navigate through everyday things. I have them over for dinner. We do things together. There are opportunities to help a refugee family set up a garden in a community garden, or maybe they have a plot of their own in their yard.
Tell us a little, Phoenix, tell us a little bit about the family that you're mentoring.
It's a mother and daughter from the Sudan, and I just can't tell you how, having met them and having brought them into my family, how it's enriched us. My children have become wonderful friends with this daughter, and, you know, we just can't have her over enough. It's just been wonderful to share cultural experiences and to help her learn her English and, you know, just ensure that she has a friend, that she has friends and that she can, you know, be confident in her new setting. And it's just been wonderful. So I encourage anyone listening to get involved with the International Rescue Committee here and get refugees into your lives. It's just really enriching and wonderful.
Phoenix, thanks very much for sharing that story. Nawal, I imagine those are the kinds of relationships, connections that you want to foster here in this community.
Exactly. Yeah, this is what we want, actually, a community to involve with the refugees. As Zine said before, I mean, you will learn from the refugees. You will learn a lot from refugees. And also, you will feel, happy that you did something and you put a smile in somebody's face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dr. Xu Cheng, last week, Salt Lake City announced a new series of classes to help educate refugees. Everything from law enforcement, you know, how to navigate the police system, tenants' rights, citizenship, many other resources. How important are these kinds of education efforts in helping refugees transition into the mainstream?
It's tremendously important because as refugees arrive, they need basically a map to navigate. And many of these lessons would teach them the way to get through this map to the destination. For instance, like family laws are very different in the United States than maybe in their own home country. In the way to teach children to relate to family conflicts. So teaching those skills would be very, very important. Our law enforcement is also another very important aspect. As you know that many of the refugees, they may have fear about or bad experience in the past with their own a law enforcement situation in the home country.
Trusting.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so for them to learn the new way and learn new way to relate to law enforcement and learn how to, conduct themselves in the right way is really important. There are also resources in the community. So by going to some of these classes, they will find different things and different ways to help with their family. And our community just full of very great volunteers, and the callers talking about their experience. I strongly encourage individuals to come out and be a friend to a refugee, because this is really what America is about, is providing opportunity for individuals who want to start a new life.
Mm. Our time is short. I want to sneak in one last phone call. This is Felicia calling from Salt Lake City. Felicia, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. The reason I'm calling is because I am the director of a nonprofit organization called the Utah Refugee Coalition, and we work very closely with Dr. Xu and Z and Nawal. I'm very excited to hear this kind of information getting out to the general community, because what we find is that there really is a lack of information, a lack of knowledge about Utah and Salt Lake City having this wonderful, diverse population. Hello?
Yes, yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I heard a dial phone. One thing that I just wanted to call in and share is that for the month of June, Governor Herbert has declared June as being Utah Refugee Month. And so we have about 20 events and activities taking place during the month where people from the general community and people from the refugee communities can come together, learn about one another, learn about the other cultures. And
seems like we're getting some interference there, Felicia. I'm going to have to let you go, but we'll put a link on our website about the World Refugee Day at kcpw.org. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Zeman Zhao is Salt Lake County's Refugee Services Liaison. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Nawal Nawal, Supervisor for Employment and Supportive Services for the Refugee and Immigrant Center. Nawal, thanks for sharing your experience.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Xu Cheng, Executive Director of the Refugee and Immigrant Center here in Salt Lake City. Dr. Cheng, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, more information about World Refugee Day and Refugee Month on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, David Brower's passion for protecting the earth. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. David Brower's role in the modern environmental movement cannot be overstated. As NPR's John Nielsen put it, calling David Brower an important environmental activist is like calling Hamlet an important member of the Danish royal court. Brower led the Sierra Club for 17 years. He founded Friends of the Earth. He founded the Earth Island Institute. He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize 3 times. He was also co-founder of the Glen Canyon Institute. And this week, the Institute will mark the 100th anniversary of Brower's birth. Today on the program, we're remembering David Brower's commitment to the environment and the legacy of his work. Joining me in studio is Dr. Rich Ingebretsen. He is a physician, a wilderness advocate, and a professor of health promotion and education in the School of Medicine at the University of Utah. He's also the founder and president of the Glen Canyon Institute, dedicated to restoring the natural beauty of Glen Canyon and the Colorado River. And Dr. Ingebretsen, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Also with us, Barbara Brower. She is a professor of geography at Portland State University. She's on the board of directors at the Glen Canyon Institute. And importantly, she's the daughter of David Brower, and she's joining us by phone from her home in Portland. And Barbara, good morning. Oh, it looks like Barbara is not there. We'll have to restore that connection. But if you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments about David Brower's imprint on modern environmentalism, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. David Brower, we know a lot about David Brower's public life. Dr. Ingebretsen, many people don't know he started out as a very accomplished mountaineer. He had that part of his life that many people don't know about.
That was one of that's right. And that gave him his passion for it. When he took over the Sierra Club, of course, it was a mountaineering club. And that's what he did. But the other part of David Brower's life was as an activist. And he took the Sierra Club, who was a mountaineering club, and converted it into an activist club where they made such many great changes. And that was one of David Brower's legacy, is his vision and his ability to change things and in a huge way.
Hmm. Looks like we now have Barbara on the line. Nope, sorry. We'll keep trying. 801-355-TALK is our number. Do you know where David Brower's commitment, his passion for conservation came from, Rich?
You know, I do. It's interesting. And Barbara, when she gets online, will tell us more. She was raised with him. But I had many long talks about David. He just had this real quick story. I once saw him standing. I was waiting to pick him up, and he was swaying back and forth. And he was 80-something years old, and I thought he was unsteady. And I said, "Are you okay, Mr. Brower?" And he said to me, "No, I'm looking at that tree that's swaying back and forth in the wind, wondering what it would be like to be a tree to sway back and forth in the wind." Mm. Now, who says that or who does that? But that was David Brower. So it was something innate in him, that his ability to understand nature. Einstein stood principles of physics. David understood nature, and he understood Western water, and he was able to make huge changes. You know, it's hard to, you know, you said about his being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He stopped 2 dams from being created in the Grand Canyon, among other things. He, along with people who did that, he saved the world's dolphins, and the organizations that he solved. One other quick story, I picked him up at the airport once, and I said, we're going to look at restoring Glen Canyon, you know, that, in one sense means taking water out of Glen Canyon, that is Lake Powell. And he looked at me, and, you know, this is such an enormous thing, and he looked at me like it was just on his to-do list. He said, "Oh, yeah, I've been meaning to take care of that," as though it was just something that needed to be done, like, you know, you go to the store and buy groceries. So he had this innate ability. And one last thing before Barbara gets on, he loved people, he loved animals, and he loved plant life. He loved things that were alive. Beautiful man.
How did you cross paths with him?
Well, because of Glen Canyon. When I became involved with the restoration of Glen Canyon, I wanted to get the giants, so I invited David Brower to come speak at the University of Utah, and he said, well, his assistant said he'd like to debate the man who built Glen Canyon Dam, Floyd Dominey. So I invited them both to come. And it was very clear from, I was talking to these giants of men, somewhat you would say lions in the winter, maybe, but that he was every bit as powerful as you can imagine. If you've ever seen a picture of David Brower, tall, imposing physically, white, flowing hair, and extremely articulate. So he had it all. He had brilliance and vision and love of the earth, and he inspired people. You could say he was an effective environmentalist. He coined the name environmentalist, but more importantly, he inspired people. I think his greatest legacy is inspiring people like me and others to go out and get things done. That was his big thing.
We're talking about David Brower, the environmentalist, the man who coined the phrase environmentalism, with Rich Engebretson. He is a physician, a wilderness advocate, also the president of the Glen Canyon Institute. And joining us now by phone from Portland is David Brower's daughter, Barbara Brower. Are you there?
I am.
Oh, terrific. I'm glad that we finally connected. Thanks so much for your time today. We know a lot about your father's public life, his accomplishments in conservation. Talk a little bit about his private life as a father. Did he take you on excursions into the Sierra Nevada that he loved? And what were his private moments with you like as a daughter?
You know, I was wondering what I was going to be able to speak to after catching a little bit of what Rich Engebretson was saying, because he certainly spoke to the public man, although I'm not sure about that environmentalism as dad's coinage, but whatever his public persona, he was a great dad in being attentive, because he was gone a lot. You don't make the kinds of changes in the world that my father was responsible for if you were home with your kids. So we missed out on some family time, but made up for it, I think, with the trips we made with him as he was campaigning for various battles, I guess. But we went to some amazing places, a lot of time in the Sierra, a lot of time throughout the West, and then particularly memorable for me and important to this conversation, I think we spent a lot of time in Glen Canyon, 5 trips altogether, both before the diversion tunnels closed and as the lake filled. So the experience of the outdoors with a man who, as Rich was saying, was so in love with it, was pretty wonderful.
How do you remember him speaking about the earth and nature?
Well, it's a shame that my elder brother Ken isn't here, because he's just finished a book on my dad, and he's been thinking about this harder than I have. Also, my two older brothers had a sort of different experience of my dad. They worked with him on books and are able to channel him a little bit better than my little brother and I can. But he was very powerfully eloquent in his public speaking, usually, although occasionally he'd bomb, and as a daughter it was always mortifying when in some audience, particularly if I knew anybody in the audience, he wasn't his typically fluent self. Mm. But he was awfully good at bringing people along to see the wonder of the world as he did. I particularly remember a time when I brought him into my class. I teach an environmental issues class, and he would often come to visit me. This was at the University of Texas, my first job, and he had been ill and was sort of gray and looked unwell. This was in his early 80s, and I felt guilty for bringing him to my class, but he came, and my poor class was demoralized, because all I can do when I talk about the environment is get depressed and depress my students. But he started talking to them, and they started paying attention, and he sort of fed off their energy and they off of his. And this man I was afraid I was killing off by taking him up the stairs to my classroom ended up at the end of the class surrounded by students who then went off with him to close the bars in Austin, and a couple of them didn't come back to class the next day. They went off to join the movement. So he really had the power to persuade.
You mentioned he was frail in his later years. He died in 2000. Barbara Brower, what do you think your father would think about the state of the environment today? And I know you've got some gloom and doom on your side, but would he be founding the Climate Change Institute? I mean, what do you think he'd be doing in our current environmental situation?
That's something that we think about a lot as we organize various celebrations of his memory, because what we're missing here, we can remember the cool things he did, but it's harder to anticipate, to sort of forecast what he might have done now, because his great gift, I think, was vision, was the ability to think ahead and also to strategize on tactics for for making people understand the seriousness of an issue like climate change, and figuring out ways to sort of get the message out there. And also, maybe his best gift was optimism. He never lost the idea that things could get better. He never was overcome with gloom and doom. He spent an awful lot of time finding ways to make the world work. And that gift is what I miss, and that vision, I think, is what I can't even begin to guess at. But I think he would be worried and working hard, but hopeful.
Rich Ingebretson, what would you like people to remember about the David Brower that you knew in 20 seconds?
Inspiration. He inspired. It's hard to describe just how inspirational he was, and eloquent. And Barbara has a lot of his ability to speak. David had ways with words, and you quoted him forever, and still do. But he inspired. He was just amazing in that. Can we announce the time of the event tomorrow night?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Tomorrow night. No, I'm sorry.
It's Friday night.
What day is it? Friday night at the incredible Utah Museum of Natural History, the new one, east of Research Park, at 7:30 is an event free to the public here in Salt Lake City.
And you'll be honoring David Brower, the Glen Canyon Institute. We'll have links on our website for more information. I'm sorry we have to cut it short. Rich Ingebretson and Barbara Brower, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks.
City Views is a production of KCPW. Thanks to Lauren Hendrickson and Eric Ray. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.